Welcome back. I'm talking to former President Mary Robinson and about the presidential years. Now, the diaspora, this was in some ways a word you began using. It was probably not very often used at that point, about those Irish who had left and who were abroad, and some of them were second and third generation. Why did you go for that particular word?
I'd been aware, as a senator visiting the United States and visiting parts of Britain, that we were not cherishing our immigrants, and that this was a problem. And I had spoken about this, and I began to use the word diaspora. People, kind of criticised using it. So I went to my father and I said, I'm going to be giving a speech to the two houses of the Oireachtas, and I want to talk about the Irish diaspora. And he said, oh, do, he said. The Irish love new words. They'll get used to it. And we did. I also felt that the diaspora was a way of opening up more space for diversity within Ireland, that the connections were ones that could be of great assistance to us in a peace process with Northern Ireland, and in a wider sense of an Irishness that went beyond just those who were resident in Ireland itself. That speech itself, which I put a lot of personal work and effort into and really felt was important for the message that I wanted to get across, didn't go down well in Leinster House. I think part of the reason was that I gave a very preachy, non-humorous speech. I stuck slightly nervously, I think. It's a very formal thing to address the two houses of the Oireachtas. And I just stuck to my script because I knew that it would take exactly the time that was allocated. And it would have been nice to start with something human, a joke or something. And also, I was being, in effect, critical of the fact that we hadn't valued and cherished and supported those in different parts of the world, that the centres who were looking after the immigrants. And therefore, this wasn't very well taken in the House. And afterwards, I felt just a little bit disappointed and sort of trying to understand. And then everybody got very excited in the Oireachtas and in my family, because messages were coming in and came in for weeks afterwards from all over the world, from nuns in the middle of Africa or India, from Ted Kennedy, who put it on the record of the of Congress, from so many people in different parts of the world. And I realised that I had struck a chord that was the same kind of link as the light in the window that I had said I would put in Oireachtas an Uachtaráin on the night of the acceptance speech, that I would put that light for all of those who had to leave Ireland so that we would be connected. And so we would. And I must say, I think it's very valuable how now in our constitution and in our approach, we do cherish the Irish, the diaspora, and we're now using a gathering to look for their support in our hard times.
And when you went abroad as president, was there a difficulty between meeting the Irish in need, as it were, and the well-heeled Irish who really wanted to have you as a sort of trophy guest?
Not really, because we planned each visit to ensure, if at all possible, that I would meet with the poor and those who were serving, particularly as priests and nuns. I remember one occasion in particular in Rio de Janeiro where a number of priests and nuns had been invited to be part of the Irish community, which we always met separately, as I think presidents do. And I went over to a number of them after they had shaken hands and said, come over here where the smoked salmon and things are and have a good meal. And they were eating rice from a bowl. And they said, no, our stomachs couldn't take it now. That food would be too rich for us. And I thought that was as much a symbol of the extraordinary work they do on the ground.
You remained a controversial president. When you went to meet the Pope, for instance, your dress sense was criticised. And here's Father David O'Hanlon, who was among your critics.
I felt shortchanged by a president who would, with great graciousness, take off her shoes entering a mosque, as I would do myself. But when she came to Rome, deliberately, it seemed to me, on a very petty issue, because what she wore is of minor importance, certainly, I felt hurt and I felt let down and I felt poorly represented by my head of state.
The criticism there was that you had not worn a mantilla.
That's right. And I did give it some thought, needless to say. And I felt if I wore a mantilla and wore black, I would be going more as a Catholic president of Ireland. And I had been very much reaching out to create a sense of diversity. I had been the first president to visit with the Jewish community, with the Muslims, as it was referenced, but also communities in Northern Ireland. I wanted to represent an Ireland that was diverse. And I felt that if I went wearing a very dark green, formal, long coat, that this was respectful. I had a very good meeting with the Pope, who was a very good human rights person. And in fact, less than a year later, when I happened to be High Commissioner for Human Rights, I was invited to come and meet the Pope because it was the eve of the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1998. We had another very good meeting, and with a great twinkle in his eye, he said, "I think you're wearing the same coat as last time," which I was, as High Commissioner.
And, very observant of him.
And I think it was actually a statement that very many women in particular appreciated. And it was certainly, the intent was to represent an inclusive Ireland.
And there was, however, astonishment. You mentioned this in the book, when you stepped out of the car, as to how you were dressed.
There was surprise by the male reception group, very high level male protocol of the Pope, and each of them was dressed in many colours with their ribbons and sashes, etc. And afterwards, it occurred to me that this is also something that I have, you know, been critical of for most of my life. It's a patriarchal approach.
At what point did you begin thinking as to whether you would seek a second term as president?
I agonised about that prior to Christmas of 1996 into early 1997.
Which would have been the year of decision.
The year of decision. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to stay on as president, but my friends were telling me, Bride was telling me, Nick was telling me, and I felt it in my heart that there is a lot of repetition, and could I really do it with the same 100% commitment for a full 7 years? And obviously you couldn't do it for 3 years and then retire. That would be unforgivable. And so this conversation was going on. I was at that stage still committed to doing a second term, but I was getting a lot of resistance from family and friends. And then Nick and myself went to Malta for a week to make a decision. And we cried a lot. I cried, and we fought and we argued. And we came back without a decision. But I was beginning to recognise that those around me were wiser than I was, and that it was probably better not to. And Bride was adamant that if I wasn't seeking a second term, I must make the announcement soon enough for there to be a good election before the end of my term, which would be in December. And therefore, we announced in March. And it was a surprise. And I was quite traumatised by having to make that decision. And it wasn't an easy one at all. I'm going to be probably even more committed to the remainder of my term, because each day is precious now. I know that I'm coming to an end of what is a very special time, a very special privilege and honour, and that there is work to be done, if I could put it that way.
So at what stage then did you form the ambition to become the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights?
Curiously, and by some serendipity, about a fortnight later, the first High Commissioner, José Ayala Lasso from Ecuador, resigned suddenly and went back to become Foreign Minister of his country. And I had been aware of the work of the Office of High Commissioner. Actually, I had met some members of the office that was based in Rwanda after some of them had been killed when I was there on one of my visits as president. And I had been aware of the work, but not closely. And I thought to myself, you know, that's something that I really would be interested in thinking about. And I sought advice from a number of people, most of whom tried to dissuade me. The office was small, demoralised, but I was a human rights person. I think I wasn't really listening. And I went to the Taoiseach of the time, John Bruton, and he said, well, my information is that that's not really a very big office. There was some talk about the ILO, which was going to have a new president. But no, I felt human rights are
my International Labour Organization,
yes.
Also in Geneva.
Yes. Yeah. And so I asked the Irish government to put my name forward, and they not only put it forward, they entered into a really very well-organised campaign globally. There were a number of other prestigious people who put their names forward, and Kofi Annan made the decision in July and decided early July decided. And I went over to New York, and he had one big ask of me, and he made it from the beginning. He said, "There isn't the High Commissioner resigned. I had to withdraw the deputy. There is nobody there except a civil servant from the legal office. This is a very difficult situation. And I need you in September for the General Assembly." And I said, "But my term goes on until December." And eventually I allowed myself to be persuaded and said I'd come on the 12th of September so that I could be there for the General Assembly the following week. And it's a decision that I regret now very much. I think when well, I...
Let's just hear the press conference there where this was announced, the announcement that you would have the nomination.
I have understood from the Secretary General that he has been very anxious to have me on board and to know the date when I would assume the post of High Commissioner. And I have indicated to him that I will retire from the Presidency of Ireland on the 12th of December at 1 p.m. and I will then be in a position to take up the post.
Did I say December?
Then if I can correct myself quickly, September. I remember that well. I was so, that was the sense I had, the fact that I said December was indicating in my heart I was actually very torn by that decision.
You write in the book that you believe this, however, was an ill-judged decision on your part and a serious miscalculation.
It was. And I recognised, quite shortly afterwards that it conveyed to quite a number of people that somehow the presidency for me was a stepping stone to something else, or that I was tired of it, or, and it was in a way, something that was counter to my whole sense of that promise to the Irish people. And I cut short the full fulfilment of that promise, even though I worked all summer, took no holiday, tried to, did everything I could. But still, I was worried that Kofi Annan might choose someone else if I said you have to wait until December. And I was also aware that the focus of most of the media now was on the fact that there was a robust, to say the least, election campaign. And that was where the news was. But it was a mistake.
And a mistake just because you had a constitutional duty to be there?
No, because the people of Ireland had trusted me to be their president for the full 7 years. I should have said to Kofi Annan, if you want me, wait for me.
Do you think he would have done that?
I think he probably would, yes, in retrospect.
And do you think some people haven't forgiven you? They still retain that as a sort of grievance or a criticism?
I don't get that sense now. I did, for about a year or two afterwards. I just felt very sad at some particularly newspaper reports that I was always ambitious about moving on to higher things. Actually, the first few months of serving as High Commissioner for Human Rights were the most difficult and painful in my life. And they really practically undermined my health.
And have you a difficulty with newspaper criticism?
Not really. I mean, I felt as president and I felt as High Commissioner, and I feel still that by and large I get, fair treatment from the press. And I genuinely am a supporter of the importance of a free and robust press. And I think it's important that people in positions of power are challenged and are accountable.
But do you tend to read media criticism if it's there?
I read anything that comes to my attention. I probably miss quite a lot because I don't look out for it.
Were you hurt at all, for instance, where there was one particular newspaper columnist who was not without a relationship to Charles Haughey, who kept referring to you in her Sunday column as her poloness?
Yes, I that wouldn't bother me at all. And I mean, we have a back corridor in our home in Mayo of the cartoons, because needless to say, Nick was always keen to get copies of any cartoons. And I have a good sense of humour, so on the whole, I wasn't really hurt.
And in all of those years as president, obviously you had the support of Nick Robinson as your husband. And he must have enjoyed that time too, because he retired from being a solicitor and instead he became a scholar and did the sort of things that he's very enthusiastic about. He, for instance, he worked on the Irish Architectural Archive He did something in the Oris itself, didn't he, in the basement?
That's right. He helped to support the Office of Public Works because they were the decider. And they both in the grounds, he spent a lot of time supporting good work being done in the surrounds of the Oris itself, but also inside. And in particular, that we would use what was a dangerous basement full of old newspapers, a fire hazard, and dank and dark when we started, to be turned into this visitor centre that would give people a context of the Viceregal Lodge, etc. Nick had retired from the position as administrator of the Centre for Human Rights in Trinity, which both of us had worked on in the last year before before I got involved in the presidential campaign. And he felt it was appropriate for him to be as supportive of me as possible. He knew that I was both committed and had to push out the frontiers of a presidency that had been hidebound by a tradition that restricted it.
He also wrote Edmund Burke, A Life in Caricature, at that time, didn't he?
He did, yes. And I was very happy to be present in the long room for the launch of it. And I felt very proud of him. He worked upstairs in our private apartments. But more than anything else, he was the friend and ally and second pair of eyes and ears. And also, we laughed a lot. We had some very funny moments. And to be able to share those at night in the bedroom, you know, because a lot of silly things happen on state visits and pompous things happen. And we used to enjoy sharing our memories of those.
And how did the presidency, in your view, change in your term, in your 7 years?
It was important to me that the office of president would be sort of strengthened in what it really is, which is the person chosen by the people of Ireland to be the head of state, to be their president over 7 years, and to serve to the best of their ability for those 7 years. And I was supported by a very good office and staff led by Peter Ryan, with Brad Rosny as my special advisor. We did give a lot of thought to what was appropriate to do and set out kind of the parameters of it. But it is a very personal choice of where you go, what you do, other than the formal occasions, which are very important, the formal occasions as head of state, which take place each year, or the ambassadors presenting credentials. And it gave me great satisfaction, I have to say, at the end of my term, that the office was so strengthened, and even more so after a robust election, that President Mary McAleese continued in the same vein and had her own priorities, her bridge building, her unique ability to link with Northern Ireland, build that peace process, continuing the relationship with Queen Elizabeth that I had commenced, and now President Michael D. Higgins. Because individuals come and go, but if an office is strengthened, as I also felt at the end of my term as High Commissioner, that's real and concrete and worthwhile. And I'm delighted that I think people feel that the presidency in Ireland is working well at a time when there's a lot of criticism of other institutions.
And did you keep a diary, for instance, when you were president?
Not a formal diary. I kept a sort of informal diary note, which I consulted when I was doing the book. But every moment of the presidency is accounted for.
And this is what your father had to say about you during those years.
What flashes through my mind about her is that she's exactly the same person as she was as a child. That's the thing that astonishes me. As a child, she was here in the house or the other. She was friendly, she was open, she had a good smile, she enjoyed things. And to me, she seems exactly the same when I see her with Clinton or the Pope, as you say, or anybody else.
What's your response to that?
I think it was difficult to be as open as I sometimes wanted to be, because people actually react to the presence of the president. And I described, you know, you'd walk towards a room full of people and it would part and you'd find yourself almost looking for somebody to come and talk to you. And it was a problem being first. I normally instinctively would prefer to be, you know, several rows back or at the side. And so characteristically, I found that difficult. But I also was very motivated to do it well. We want a president who will do us proud was ringing in my ears for those 7 years. And as I said, it was the opportunity to relax and be have fun with family and friends that was so precious.
But it meant you couldn't go into a bookshop, for instance, probably without
That was the one thing I did go into several times, both in Dublin and Galway, and browse. But then I found people were noting where I was and what books I was looking at, and it was a bit awkward.
And so was there a difference then, coming down from that to go into the UN, which the office was not in good shape that you went into in Geneva?
It was not in good shape, and it was actually in worse shape than people had warned me. It was an office which had been created after the World Conference Against on Human Rights in 1993. There'd been one person before, and there had not been a good relationship between a pre-existing Centre for Human Rights, which had its own director, and the first High Commissioner. They had fought. And luckily, Secretary General Kofi Annan had had a July reform package, which for the first time positioned the Office of High Commissioner very strategically in the UN on each of the four big executive committees on peace and security, on development, on economic and social rights, on humanitarian affairs, and also said that there would be no more Centre for Human Rights. It was subsumed into the office. And so I had a huge mandate and a small demoralised workforce and almost no resources. People were holding on to paperclips and paper because you hid them in your desk because they'd be taken because the office had no money. It was quite extraordinary.
And being former president, was that now a difficulty for you? Was the change very difficult because of the two offices being so different?
The change was very abrupt because, again, I think this was a mistake in retrospect. I didn't take a holiday because I was so concerned about leaving early. So I went straight on the 12th of September from being president to being High Commissioner for Human Rights. And on that first evening, sitting in a little restaurant not too far from our home with Aubrey, who was already starting school, he was 16, starting the international school in Geneva, and Nick and Bride, it was both pleasant and odd to be able to just sit there at a table in the open air with others and have no security. And I found that I was having to adjust to very simple things. I mean, Bride did the big tease about when we went to the General Assembly the following week and went into the big building, and I had to go up to the 29th floor where the Office of High Commissioner was. And when we stood in the elevator, nothing happened. And then Bride, after a minute or two, said, "Yeah, Mary, nothing's going to happen unless you press the button." It was as bad as that. You know, everything had been so done for me. And I had to learn to call taxis, to use the language of a cab and things in the trunk, and learn to pay for things properly. You know, just everything is very much organised for the president, and every day is set out in a very clear way. And the office of president was extremely well run. I had a number of difficulties, even with individuals in the Office of High Commissioner. It was a different thing to head an office that was multilateral and have different cultural things. So there were some people coming into my office and I would ask them to do something very specific and quite urgent. And they would say, "Yes, High Commissioner." But their idea was, "Yes, High Commissioner, I'm getting out of here as quickly as I can. And I'm not necessarily going to do what you ask."
Well, we'll talk about the challenges of that in our next programme. Mary Robinson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mary Robinson's autobiography, Everybody Matters, is published by Hodder and Stoughton. Tomorrow night, shaping the agenda for human rights at the UN and shaping the office, both the role itself and the paperclips.
I found that I was getting up earlier every morning, staying longer in the office, and I began taking sleeping pills because I was so worried I wasn't sleeping well at night. And so between September of 1997 and that first Christmas as High Commissioner, I found it the hardest work and the most difficult, and that I was finding it very difficult to get totally on top of it, and it was taking its toll.
Her campaigning then and since on gender equality and on climate justice.
It's estimated we could have 200 million climate displaced people, many of them from Africa. Where will they go?
And her friendship with Nelson Mandela and Bishop Desmond Tutu.
She cares about poverty, she cares about injustice, she cares about oppression. I love her.
That's tomorrow night, just after the 10 o'clock news on RTE Radio 1.